We turn once again this morning to our studies in the prophecy of Isaiah in these closing chapters from chapter 40 to the end of the prophecy of Isaiah. We're looking at thoughts and themes out of these chapters from chapter 40. The book of Isaiah is called the Book of Consolation. It begins, comfort ye my people. It says, your God. And we find that these chapters are referred to fairly frequently in the New Testament. And as we have been seeing, and as we're going to see further, Isaiah reaches heights of eloquence and thought that are hardly surpassed anywhere in the entire Scripture. The whole of these final chapters are high reaching and far-ranging. They deal with some of the issues of Isaiah's own day. They deal with some issues in the near future. They deal with some issues in the further future. They deal with the coming of Christ. These chapters deal with issues concerning the age in which we are living today, the Christian age. And they deal also with the new heaven and the new earth in the closing two chapters of Isaiah. So there is no question that these final chapters of Isaiah are among the most instructive and encouraging in the whole of the Bible. And one of the ways that we find that God encourages his people right from the very beginning is to tell them of things that are going to come to pass. We find this right at the beginning. You remember in Genesis chapter 3, where our first parents sinned. And one of the first things that we read concerning God's words to fallen humanity is that he's going to send a redeemer. He will send the seed of the woman who will come to crush the head of the serpent. You remember the very first words that are spoken by God to fallen man in Genesis. Where art thou? Where are you? And the rest of the Bible is really a record, an unfolding narrative of the way that God has sought after man in order to save him. And that is why the Bible is written, to make us wise unto salvation through faith in Christ Jesus. I think we need to keep this firmly in mind because we sometimes lose track and lose sight of this great theme, and we use the Bible for all kinds of partisan and really at times very strange doctrines and notions of our own. And sometimes we have our own pet themes, but the main theme of the Bible is the theme of salvation. It doesn't explain to us all about creation or providence. It doesn't explain to us even all about grace, but it does give us enough information to be going on with. And one of the ways that God would encourage us is to tell us of things that he plans to do in the future, as well as reminding us of what he is doing in the present and has already done for us in the past. So that's the world view that is presented to us in the Bible generally, and that is the world view that is presented to us particularly in these closing chapters in Isaiah. And that's why we're looking at them, because Isaiah is living in tough times. The 10 northern tribes are about to be taken away and disappear forever from history as far as we know. And in the near future, the two remaining tribes, Benjamin and Judah, are going to be carried away into Babylon for a period of about 70 years. They're going to be restored, but nonetheless, they're going to be greatly decimated, and they will never, ever, ever recover their former strength or glory. And even the temple that was going to be rebuilt is going to be a small thing in comparison to Solomon's great temple. We know that Herod the Great enlarged the temple, but it wasn't anything as really important and as godly in a sense as the original temple had been. That was gone forever. So here in these chapters, we're looking at history, we're looking at providence, we're looking at grace, we're looking at prophecy. Last Sunday morning, you remember, we were in chapter 46 and concentrating our minds particularly on verses 9 to 11. And the theme that we were emphasizing last time was the fact that God is purposeful in all that he does. And these verses remind us of how God doesn't do things, say, haphazardly. He doesn't simply do what we do so often, responding to circumstances. It's amazing how much of your life and my life is not simply what we're planning to do, but really what other people are doing or not doing, which influences us. And we, by and large, spend our days responding to a whole host of things, whether it be the weather or whether it be whatever it be. We are simply responding, but God doesn't deal like that. He plans and he accomplishes according to his program, and he does things first things first. So we were looking last time at this theme that God is purposeful in all that he does. And we need to keep this in mind even in times such as Isaiah was living in, when the people of God were declining on the one hand and the enemies of God's people were increasing, and they were increasingly encroaching and increasingly confident. The Assyrians were the empire that was rising at the time of Isaiah. But he speaks of other empires too, as we're going to see this morning. So we come then to chapter 47. And as we've been saying over and over again, there are times we're going to be looking at one verse. There are going to be in another couple of chapters or so, I'm going to be looking at two individual verses for two successive weeks out of these chapters, because I think they're important. And sometimes we take a theme, sometimes we take a few verses, sometimes we take a whole chapter. This morning we're going to take a whole chapter. We're going to be looking at chapter 47. And the theme of this chapter from beginning to end is one theme. It is the fall of Babylon. And what makes this theme so strange in a sense, or this prophecy, and it is a prophecy, what makes it so strange is that here is a quite detailed as well as a specific a prophecy concerning the end of Babylon, but Babylon hasn't even arisen at the time that these words were first recorded. If we believe in the authenticity of Isaiah, then these words that we're considering this morning were words referring to events some 200 or so years after the prophet is writing. Babylon is not even the empire of the day that is affecting Israel. Assyria is. But here the prophet is recording the destruction of an empire which has yet to come. And that is one of the things that we find in a number of places in the Bible. There are other empires mentioned in the Old Testament, in the book of Daniel, for example, as well as in the prophecy of Isaiah, reminding us that God knows what opponents his people are going to contend with in every generation, but also reminding us that these empires only last for a time. The people of God continue forever. Christ builds his church, and that church, that city that God builds, the city of God, will remain. The city of man, whatever city it is, will not remain. It is a temporary edifice only. And here we are being reminded of Babylon and its fall. And the reason that we're being reminded of Babylon particularly, rather than Assyria, is because Babylon is going to afflict and affect the two tribes where Isaiah is ministering, the tribes in Jerusalem, the tribe of Benjamin and Judah. And so it is particularly to these people that the words of the prophet Isaiah have relevance. He has a wider ministry, but he is ministering in Jerusalem, as we know from the opening verses of the whole of the prophecy, during the reign of four of the great kings of Judah in Jerusalem. And so it is Babylon which is going to be the great danger to the people of Judah, not Assyria. It is Babylon that is going to carry them away. It is Babylon that is going to afflict them. It is Babylon which is going to meet its God-appointed doom. And that is what this prophecy in chapter 47 is all about. And I want us to think of this this morning. We saw a couple of weeks ago, you remember, the raising up of Cyrus the Persian, the founder of the great Persian Empire, one of the great men of history. and how he liberated the Jewish people and sent them and all other nations too who were held captive by the Babylonians. He gave them a bill of liberty, a charter of liberty to go back and to re-establish their national life and their national religion. And he comes into the biblical narrative not because he was the great man of history as such, but because of what he did for Israel. And that is, as far as the Bible is concerned, concerning the great works of Cyrus, the great man. But here we're dealing with the end of Babylon. And this is before Cyrus enters into the city, or at the same time. We know that the fall of Babylon and the entrance of the Persians took place in the year 539, or 538 seems to be the more modern scholarly date. But anyway, the point is the fall of Babylon and the entry of Cyrus took place more or less simultaneously. But Cyrus entered the city of Babylon the day after his generals had entered with the army of the Persians. Well, anyway, here we're going to be looking at this fall of Babylon. And this actually took place way back in the year 539 or 538. So here we have history recorded before it actually took place, and it is the fall of Babylon in some detail. Now, there are a number of issues that we want to look at this morning as we consider this. We might think, well, what on earth has this got to do with us? Well, it has everything to do to us because, as we're going to see in our studies in the book of Revelation, in a week or two, we're going to be introduced to Babylon, and we're going to be introduced in the 18th chapter to the fall of Babylon. Now, I didn't plan these sermons out so that we've got Babylon in our view over the next week or two in our studies on Sunday mornings and on Wednesday evenings. It just happened to be that that's the way it happened. But we follow the scriptures wherever they lead, and we take what comes. And it just happens to be that in God's good providence, maybe he has something to say for us. And from all eternity, perhaps for all we know, he has planned that these themes occupy our minds for these number of weeks. I don't know the mind of the Lord, but we just follow the Bible and take it as we find it. There are a number of themes that we look at concerning the fall of Babylon. We're told in the opening five verses that this is a divine judgment upon Babylon. We're told that this comes from the hand of God. We're told in verse 3, for example, I will take vengeance and will not meet thee as a man. As for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Who is it that is saying to Babylon, come down? Who is it that is saying to Babylon, sit thou silent and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans? For thou shalt no more be called the Lady of the Kingdoms. And there's no question whatsoever that the fall of Babylon, according to the teaching of the Bible, is a divine activity. It is something that God does to Babylon. It is not something that just happens. Maybe outwardly, the historians, they don't record the fall of Babylon in the same way that the prophet Isaiah records the fall of Babylon. They record the fall of Babylon through internal weakness. We know that the night that Babylon fell to the Persians, we know from Daniel's prophecy, chapter 5, that the last king in Babylon, Belshazzar, you remember, that he had a drunken orgy. He saw the writing on the wall, all right, not only literally, but politically and militarily. He knew that all was up. He knew that he had offended his people, that they were willing to embrace the Persian army. They were sick and tired of this reign of kings in Babylon, and they'd had enough of Babylonian rule, and they wanted a change of rulership. And Belshazzar knew that he was going to be the last of the line. So when he saw the Persian armies approaching, indeed they were all round him, they were on the other side of the canals that surrounded Babylon, and the doors were being opened actually. He and his courtiers had a great party, a final farewell, you remember, and there was a drunken debauch. And all the captains and all the mighty men in Babylon, they got boozed up. And they were drinking not only out of the usual utensils, but they went into the storehouse. And they took out as a final affront to the God of Israel, They took out the holy vessels that were meant for pouring out libations to the Lord God of Israel. And they poured drink, wine into these vessels, and they were drinking to the gods of wood and stone in Babylon, drinking out of these holy vessels of the Lord. And it was at that point that the Lord said to King Belshazzar, "You've gone too far now. There's no hope for you. The kingdom is going to be taken from you tonight." You see, maybe the kingdom wouldn't have been taken from Babylon if they put up a fight and feared the Lord, but they didn't do either. And God gave them over. The kingdom is taken away from you and it's going to be given to another. It's going to be given to the king of the Persians. And it's the same principle that we find, I suppose, in all kingdoms that fall. Human writers and historians will look at it from one perspective and say, well, it was natural. Internal decay, every civilization destroys itself in the end. But then when we come to the Bible, we find that it is God who raises them up and God who brings them down. And so what we have here is a picture of God dealing in history with the greatest power of its age, the Empire of Babylon. And it is something that he raises up in order to chastise his people. We know that from the book of Daniel. The Lord gave the people of Israel and the king of Judah, you remember, he gave them into the hand of the king of Babylon. It was the Lord's doing. The fall of Judah was the Lord's doing. The fall of Babylon in turn is also the Lord's doing. It is God who does these things with nations, according to the Bible. And so there is an everlasting, indeed a perennial principle here, because these things apply in our day also, as we're going to see in the book of Revelation, chapters 17 and 18, that Babylon at the end is going to be destroyed under the wrath of God, just as this literal Babylon is being destroyed under the wrath of God. So this is not some kind of natural rule, natural law. It's not some kind of internal weakness and a greater military might comes. All that is true in a sense. But behind it all is the hand of the Lord. You remember in our studies in the book of Habakkuk, a way back some time ago, we saw that it was God who was bringing that hasty nation, the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation. And you remember how we saw the prophet Habakkuk saying that God would bring them down also in his due time. He would deal with them in turn. As they had dealt to others, so he would deal to them. Now, there's a great question, of course, arises when we consider this whole issue of God dealing in judgment and in wrath, because the picture here is one of total desolation. Come down, sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon, sit on the ground. There is no throne left, O daughter of Chaldeans. You shall no more be called tender and delicate. You are now going to be brought down to the level of others. Take the millstone, grind meal, uncover thy locks, make bare thy leg. Here's a picture of humiliation. Here is a picture of a great people being brought down, so to speak, down to a position that they never dreamed that they would ever experience. Thy nakedness shall be uncovered, yea, thy shame shall be seen. You're going to be exposed for the filthy creature that you really are. I will take vengeance and will not meet thee as a man. In other words, I am going to bring you down low. And so here is a picture of a total destruction. And we have to ask the question, why is it that God deals so severely with people and with sin in general in this particular kind of way? And I think it's something we have to face fairly and squarely, because the Bible has got a great deal to say about the judgment of God, even to the extent that there are some people who read the Bible and they find it rather off-putting, because they say all we seem to find in the Bible is the God of the Bible punishing people. Well, there is certainly a great deal of that undoubtedly in the Scripture. You can't read through the Bible without coming clearly to the conviction that whatever else God is, he is a God who judges people according to their sinfulness. And we have to ask the question, well, why is it that God is so aroused to bring people down to such a degree of destruction and humiliation? Is this fair? Is this the right thing to do? What purpose possibly could God have to do such a thing to this mighty city of Babylon? After all, there were women and children and relatively innocent people in that city of Babylon as well as the most guilty. And there are various views put forward, of course, as to this whole issue, because the issue here really is a question of justice. Is it right for God to deal with a whole community of people in this particular kind of way? It does raise the issue, doesn't it, of what is justice, what is right? How do you deal with any kind of wrongdoing? And there are three basic ideas concerning this, and the jurists amongst us will know what some of these ideas are. You'll know what all of them are. And there are some which come into flavor and popularity at times, and others go out of flavor. And the first idea is that you indeed perform justice, whether it be in the criminal or in the civil code or in the moral sphere. You implement justice and judgment in order to deter other people from doing the same kind of thing. The deterrence factor. And that's very popular in our society and among our lawmakers today. Not as popular as it once was, because there's a more popular one today. But nonetheless, there is the deterrent value that is raised from time to time. And this is raised particularly in the issue of the death penalty. Because there's no question that what we're dealing with in the fall of Babylon, in many cases of individuals, is the death penalty. Many of them are going to die. Belshazzar was slain the night that he had his drunken debauchery party. He was killed. And others of his courtiers died with him. So this is not some smooth takeover without the shedding of blood. There is death in view here when the Lord is speaking of the doom of Babylon. And as we were seeing on Wednesday evening concerning the bowls of judgment in Revelation chapter 16, it is death in the end and the tormenting of men. And so there are those who say, well, when you consider the death penalty, there are those who are in favor because they say it's a deterrent. And there are others who, as it were, refuse that argument. We don't have time this morning to go into that kind of thing. That's not the point that I'm making. The issue is that the collapse of Babylon and God visiting Babylon is not to deter other nations from doing the same thing. For the simple reason it did not deter them from doing the same thing. It did not deter the Persians. It did not deter the Greeks. It did not deter the Romans. It did not deter any other history, any other nation in history that has risen up as a monstrous nation. The deterrent factor is very, very ineffective. And the point is this. He never says that he is going to deal with Babylon in this total destruction in order to deter other empires from ever laying their fingers upon his dear people ever again. Plenty of nations have laid their fingers upon God's people Israel, as we know from the Nazi Holocaust, for example. And anti-Semitism is ripe in the world again today. And then there's another principle that is raised, and that is the reformation of the offender. But there is no mention in the whole of the narrative of Babylon or the fall of Babylon that it ever was reformed, that it ever changed its ways and came to be worshippers of the God of Israel. We do believe that Nebuchadnezzar came to fear God. We know of his great experience, how he was cast down and humiliated by God for 7 years or so. Times passed over him. And how he came to recognize that there was a God in heaven who did as he pleased among the armies of heaven and amongst the inhabitants of the earth, and none could stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? That came from the lips of King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 4. He learned the lesson that the God of Israel was not to be trifled with. And we have reason to believe, and E.J. Young puts a case forward why we should believe that Nebuchadnezzar did become a God-fearing man. He became an Israelite indeed in that sense before he died. But there's no mention of the conversion of Babylon in the Bible. And therefore, when we think of the fall of Babylon, we're not to think of it in terms of deterring other empires or reforming the Babylonians. They were not reformed. And that leaves the third one, and that it is punishment. It is the punishment for things that they have done. There are some things that are so wicked and so evil that they simply cannot go without a comment being made upon them, a comment of condemnation, and some activity that brings home a penalty that is suitable to the offense that they have committed. And so when we think of the destruction of Babylon, we are not to think of God in some kind of momentary, capricious outburst of uncontrolled pique. We are to think of the Almighty God having considered the issue, knowing all the facts involved in what Babylon has done and what Babylon is, and that what God is doing is justice. He is doing this to Babylon because Babylon deserves to be destroyed. You see, there is a further principle in God's outpouring of wrath and destruction of evil. And I was commenting on it a few weeks ago in the midweek meeting. It is the preservation of His own people. It is the preservation of His creation. If the Babylonians are allowed to continue unhalted and unrestricted in any way, they will go from bad to worse. And life on earth will become hell on earth. You've got to destroy the likes of Babylon. Just as we were seeing, you have to destroy the likes of Hitler. You can't allow them to rampage around the world. You must bring them down. You must demolish their power structure. You must dismantle the system. And if that means destroying their military forces, then destroy their military forces. Render them incapable of continuing. That's the picture, you see. And in order to preserve His creation, and in order to preserve His people for further service to Him, God must destroy those who would destroy them. You see, one of the first things that the Persian king Cyrus did when he entered in, it wasn't the very first thing, but it was very soon on his agenda. In the first year of Cyrus the king, within 12 months of his reign in Babylon, he issued decrees that people should go free. There was no such decree ever issued from any Babylonian monarch. Nebuchadnezzar, in many ways, was a great king. He was a great builder. He reigned for over 40 years or so. He was in many ways a man of stature. And it seems that he treated the Jewish people under his control rather kindly. He was kind to them, as we know from the narrative in the book of Daniel. But they were still his prisoners. They were serving him. There was no decree ever issued by Nebuchadnezzar to let these people go. As far as he was concerned, they were in Babylon to stay. They were never going to return to Jerusalem ever, ever, ever again. They were never going to be restored in Jerusalem to build their temple and continue as a nation under God. And if these people were to continue, then some other king must replace the Babylonian line, a king who would set them free. Not because he had high moral standards and the fear of Jehovah. He had his political reasons also, but nonetheless they were good. And in God's providence of overruling everything for good, His people were set free, you see. There are reasons to believe that after the death of Nebuchadnezzar, several minor monarchs took over from the great king. None of them reached his stature. And there are reasons to believe that none of them reached his consideration of kindness towards the people of Israel or any other people imprisoned by the Babylonian Empire. It seems that the afflictions of God's people and other people increased towards the end of the Babylonian Empire. And time has now come to put a stop to it. And God intervenes. And so, yes, the Persians were used, but they were instruments in the hand of God. You remember what we saw in chapter 45 when we're considering the raising up of King Cyrus. You don't know me, but I know you, and you are my shepherd. You are my Christ. You are my anointed one to do something for my people. You don't know what you're doing, but nonetheless you're doing it. And the Lord was going to use the Persians in order to restore and preserve his people. And that can only be done when the Persians come and when the Babylonians go. And so what we have here is a picture of God wreaking vengeance upon the Babylonians and bringing to an end a cruel regime against his people. And they are going to be dealt with according as they have done. And so are you and so am I. We are going to be judged by this great God according to what we have done in the body, whether it be good or whether it be bad. And this raises the issue, what exactly is it that the Babylonians had done that arouses God's anger against them and brings them to such a pass where they are totally destroyed and they disappear from history as a mighty people? And the rest of the chapter actually explains that to us. Verses 1 to 5 speak generally of this destruction of the city of Babylon. Sit thou silent and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more, never again, will you be called the lady of the kingdoms, the queen among the empires of the world. And from verse number 6 onwards, we're given a detailed list of reasons why it is that God deals with them in this particular way. What is the first reason that God gives? And it's very interesting, it's very important, it comes top of the list because of the oppression that they had done to his people. I was angry with my people. I have polluted my inheritance. And I gave them into your hand, he says. This is verse number 6. So on the one hand, I was doing something to them. I was angry with them. I was chastising them. I was giving them for a time into your hand. Now, what did you Babylonians do to my people? You did show no mercy. Upon the ancient hast thou very heavily laid thy yoke. And the very first thing that God is angry with the Babylonians for is because of the cruel, the unnecessarily cruel way that they treated his people. They were shown no mercy. Even God, when he was handing over his people into their hand, was in a sense showing them mercy. He was seeking to cure them as a father would seek at times to take the rod of chastisement, because he is seeking to cure his child of some aberrant behavior or some characteristic that will bring the child down and cause trouble in the end. And so sometimes God's chastisements are mercies in disguise. He takes off the kid gloves. He puts on the armored gauntlet. But the armored gauntlet is still the hand of love. Those whom he loves, he chastises. But there was no such thought, you know, in the mind of the Chaldeans. You remember how Habakkuk saw them coming, that bitter and hasty nation. And all they were interested in it. In as far as the people of Israel was concerned, all that they were concerned about for God's people was that they should enslave them and make them a subordinated people, cruelty to God's people. We can think, for example, of another ancient empire in the Bible that was dealt with rather strictly and apparently harshly for the very same reason, the kingdom of Egypt. Way back in the early chapters in the book of Genesis, why was it that the Lord poured out these 10 plagues upon the people of Egypt in those chapters in Exodus? Well, we're told why. They refused to liberate God's people. Indeed, they made their servitude and their bondage even harsher. They now gave them not even straw for bricks. They now had to go into the fields and cut their own straw. And the people of Israel were not only in slavery to the Egyptians, but increasingly in slavery. And you remember how the people of Israel, they were complaining about Moses and Aaron, and they said, since you've come, life has become harder for us, because Pharaoh has imposed upon us burdens that he never imposed before. Life was becoming increasingly harsh. And it was because life was becoming increasingly harsh for his people that life was going to become increasingly harsh for the Egyptians. And the principle is the same right down through history. And it was the same in the Assyrians. They were destroyed. You remember they were destroyed when the angel of the Lord swept through the camp. And 120,000 of them were slain in one night. And the Babylonians, they were brought down. And God says it's because of what you did to my people. You showed them no pity whatsoever. You may well have taken them into captivity, but you might at least have treated them kindly. And indeed, the harshness and the lack of mercy increased towards the end. And look at the way how he says upon the ancient, the old ones, the old enfeebled ones, the old men and women who no longer have the strength of their former youthfulness, and how you dealt with them very harshly and used them in severe servitude and bondage. Now here we have a principle that we find not only in the book of Exodus and in the book of Isaiah and the book of Daniel, but we find it right throughout the Bible. We're going to see it when we come to the fall of Babylon in Revelation chapter 18. Because Babylon was drunk with the blood of the martyrs, the blood of the saints. Now, I'm not going to start making unnecessarily great claims for the Christian community or God's people in the world. But the Bible does describe them as His chosen ones. It describes them as His anointed ones. It describes them as the apple of His eye, and you don't touch them. In the same way as you and I with our little children, we don't mind what people will do to us. But leave our children alone. Don't touch our children. There's something of revulsion rises up in the heart of any right-thinking man or woman or adult of any kind, parent or not, that someone should lay their filthy hands upon our beloved children. That's the picture that God presents to us of His own attitude to His people in the Bible. They belong to me. They're my children. I will discipline them. And I may lay my heavy hand upon them, but you dare not. It doesn't do, you know, to say too much criticism against the people of God. It doesn't do to lay your hand in persecution and opposition and oppression against God's people. I will repay. Vengeance belongs to me. In other words, God says to His people, don't you retaliate. You pray for your oppressors. But I'll deal with them. And I'll deal with them because of what they've done for you and what they've done to you. You see, the Lord is jealous over His people. He cares for them. He puts His protecting arms around them. And woe betide any individual who molests one of God's people. And woe betide any nation or empire that seeks to destroy God's people in such a manner that they will never again be allowed to live as a free people under God. And God will bring that nation down. And that's exactly what we've got here. So the first thing that God says by way of explanation as to why it is He is dealing so apparently harshly and severely with the Babylonians is because they have dealt harshly with His own children. That's the first reason. But then there's another reason. Verses 7 to 9 tells us of the sheer pride of Babylon. The pride of place, the pride of security. We are the people. The Bible tells us that God resists the proud, and He will bring low the proud, and He will exalt the humble. And thou saidst, I shall be a lady forever. I am here, I am the kingdom of the day, and I will be the kingdom for tomorrow. The good times have come with us, and the good times are here to stay, because we will secure the good times. I shall be a lady forever, for thou didst not lay these things to thy heart. You weren't caring about my people. Neither didst remember the latter end of it. In their pride, they weren't really seeing the slavery of the people under them. In their pride of remaining and the sheer presumption that things were going to be like this forever, they weren't considering the possibility, who in the wide world is going to raise against us and destroy this great city of Babylon? You remember what Nebuchadnezzar said? In the book of Daniel chapter 4 at verse number 30, he was walking up on his battlements one day up on the roof of his palace or somewhere. Look at this great city of Babylon that I have built. This great city of Babylon. And it was at that point that the Lord gave him the warning, you're going to be brought low. That was the spirit of Babylon, you see. They had one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. The scholars wonder whether such thing ever existed or not. It may well have been terraces that the king put there for one of his wives, his favorite wife. She came from a mountainous part, and she liked the idea of mountains and growing things on the sides of mountains. That possibly was the tower, the Hanging Gardens. We don't know for sure. But the point is that pride was right at the heart of it. And the Bible makes it very clear, the proud man's going to have a come down. The proud nation's going to have a come down. And here is Babylon, and it is inconceivable for these Babylonians in their pride, it is inconceivable that they can be destroyed. They don't not consider their latter end. Neither didst remember the latter end of it. Now remember, all of this is prophesied for the people of God before the event took place. The Jews in Babylon knew what the end of Babylon was going to be, because their prophet Isaiah had already told them what the end of Babylon was going to be. They knew, the people of Israel knew, that Babylon was going to be brought low at the hand of the Lord. At least if they read their Bible, they would know it. Daniel certainly knew it. Therefore, hear now this, thou that art given to pleasures, pride and pleasure, hedonistic lifestyle, thou that dwellest carelessly, that sayest in thine heart, I am, none else is beside me, I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood, they shall come upon thee in their perfection, that's in their fulfillment to the completion, for the multitude of thy sources and for the great abundance of thine enchantments. When Hitler, that mad man, bad man, established the Nazi regime in Germany from 1933 onwards, he said, we're going to build the Third Reich, the Third Empire of Germany. And it's going to last for 1,000 years. It lasted for 12, 13 at the most. It didn't enter his head the possibility, who can stand up against us? It never seemed to have entered his head that within a few short years it was going to be falling and tumbling around him. Pride, you see. And the pleasures that blind to reality, they just don't see it. And if you were to say to a Babylonian some 20 or 10 years before the final decline and death of it, that within a decade or two you're going to live to see the destruction of it, it would have been something that was so outrageously foolish they wouldn't even have considered it. In the same way as the Jewish people, they never considered the possibility that their temple, because the end of the temple is the end of the world, you see. They couldn't think otherwise. And the danger is that we might enter into this kind of thinking. Pride of denominational achievement, pride of our own personal progress in the faith, pride of the culture that we belong to. Christianity belongs to our kind of people. And it may well be that we have to change our thinking, because pride can enter in, like many other sins, just one little step at a time. Pride of place. The Bible continually exhorts us to humble ourselves and to consider our latter end, to think about how am I going to end up. That's not fatalism or moroseness. But we are living in a world, and particularly in this land of Australia, the lucky country, where there seems to be a kind of aversion to any possibility that we might lose our liberty as a nation and lose our prosperity and lose our good old Christianity. We like to think of ourselves as a Christian nation. Well, maybe at one time we were a kind of a Christian nation, I don't know. There are many Christians in the nation. But Australia officially today is a secular democracy, and all religions go. It doesn't matter which one you want, you can have it. Pride of liberty from the tyranny of a particular religion. We'll come back to that in a moment before the end of the sermon. I must rush on. Not only was there the oppression of God's people and their pride and their pleasure, and it's going to last forever, and the thought that it can all come tumbling down in a moment is unthinkable. They would never have dreamed it. But then also at verse 10, we're given another reason why God brings them down. And it's because of the sheer wickedness of the place. For thou hast trusted in thy wickedness. Thou hast said, none seeth me. In other words, nobody really understands. Nobody. I'm going to get away with this, you see. Sin's done in secret. I'll get away with it. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge, it has perverted thee. And thou hast said in thy heart, I am and none else beside me. The arrogance and the wickedness that allows men and women to imagine that they can do as they please, and they forget that your sin will find you out. And sin perverts the thinking. Notice this in the middle of verse 10. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge, it has perverted you. They were wise. They had astrologers. Indeed, in the ancient world, Babylon was looked to by many other nations as being a land for scholars. There were astronomers. There were great mathematicians there. They knew about agriculture. They knew about navigation. They knew a great deal about medicine. They knew a great deal about architecture and underfloor sewage systems and underfloor air conditioning. These people were not living in caves, you know. And all this wisdom was real enough. But it perverted them in the great issues of life, because they thought that life is just like the rich farmer in the gospel, who in reality was a fool. He was a most astute businessman. His farms produced multiple surpluses. Much goods laid up for many years. That's good farming. That's wise agricultural practice, I would think. The man must have known what he was doing when he was planting his seeds, the proper time and the proper place. He must have been a very, very astute businessman. But he was a fool because it had blinded him to the temporary nature of his life and to the reality of his accountability to God. And thy wisdom and thy knowledge, it has perverted you. I fear for this land of Australia for this reason, that the present election campaign has deteriorated away from any possibility of a high moral ground to crass materialism. Who's going to throw the most money at you poor electorates? You vote me and I'll give you. Caesar used to say, when people are discontented, give them bread. Our present politicians say, give them money. Fling money at them. Promise them it. Promise them the moon. It perverts, you see. The thinking goes wrong. The Bible tells us that only righteousness exalts a nation, and sin is a disgrace and a shame to any people. And then finally, not only the oppression of God's people and the pride of place and the sheer power and the wickedness of military power wickedness. They were a cruel people. Not as cruel as the Assyrians, it turns out, but they were cruel enough. And we know that. Even Nebuchadnezzar. Remember the time he was going to throw the three young men into the fiery furnace? Even our present crop of politicians wouldn't get off with that. But he would think nothing of doing it. You either do as I say or I throw you into a fire and I'll make it seven times hotter than it usually is. And throwing them in alive. That was rather a cruel thing to do, was it not? That was the Babylonian monarch, you see. That was Nebuchadnezzar. But then from verse 11 to 15, I won't comment on each verse, but here we have the multiplicity of false religions. Therefore shall evil come upon thee, thou shalt not know from whence it riseth. Mischief shall fall upon thee, thou shalt not be able to put it off. Desolation shall come upon thee suddenly, which thou shalt not know. You won't know, but why does this come? Stand now with your enchantments, and with the multitude of thy sorceries, wherein thou hast labored from thy youth. Verse 13, thou art wearied in the multitude of thy counsels. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators stand up and save thee. In other words, these were people who were under the domination of stargazing, astrology, superstition, false religion of every conceivable kind. And notice the ineffectiveness of all of this false religion. And notice also the sheer weariness of it all. From verse 12, 13, 14, we're told here that wherein thou hast labored from thy youth, idolatry is really hard work. Verse 13, thou art wearied. In other words, here are these people in Babylon. They are committed, they are wedded to a false religion. And they're getting tired in it, but they're not getting tired of it. Verse 14, behold, they shall be a stubble, the fire shall burn them, they shall not deliver themselves from the power of the flame, there shall not be a coal to warm at, nor fire to sit before it. In other words, there's no comfort in it. When your gods are found in the end, when your religion is found to be not working, that is the ultimate dismay. The ultimate, we have wasted our youth, we have spent our life in vain. That must be a terrible thing to face, the possibility that all our lives we have been wrong. Thus shall they be unto thee with whom thou hast labored. These gods, Bel, Nebo, Marduk, and among the female ones, Ishtar, and they had others as well. Whatever you wanted, you could have it in Babylon. It was all there. If you were a woman wanting fertility, you could go to a certain goddess and she would do whatever they do. And if you were a farmer or a navigator wanting to deepen a channel in the great Euphrates, then you would go to the god of navigation and he would tell you where to do it. In our modern culture of Australia, any religion is as good as any other one or as bad. People in the train, people traveling to work, opening their newspapers. What does my horoscope sign have for me today? Do you read horoscopes? I hope you don't. And if you do, I hope you don't take it seriously. Because that is idolatry, sorcery, necromancy. It is turning away from God for guidance and for hope for the future. It's turning away from Christ and to foolishness. And you're wasting your time and you're wearying yourself, and at the end you're going to be disappointed. And so here is Babylon, oppressing God's people, proud of its imagined achievement, thinking it's going to last forever. Military power, military wickedness. And it's all to do with a moral problem in the end. The great issue of our society today is not an economic issue. It's not a political issue. It's not an issue of not enough housing or not enough infrastructure. It's a moral problem. We are morally bankrupting ourselves as a nation. And I see no sign on whichever horizon I look at, left, right, or center, whatever color it be, that there is any hope that this nation will make its choices for future leadership and future direction on the basis of moral considerations rather than economic considerations, which are always, of course, open to change as things change. But the God of the Bible does not change. And today God is angry with people like the Babylonians, and he's angry with nations like the Babylonians. And sooner or later he will visit them. But he loves his people. You, he says, have touched my people. I was angry with my people. There are times when God is angry with his people. But they are still his people. And he never casts them off. And he never stops loving them. And he never stops saving them. And that's what our gospel is all about. Isaiah is speaking of his own day. He's speaking of our day. He's speaking of the last day. Because Babylon is very much alive and well today. Not the city of Babylon. You'll find it about 50 miles or so from present-day Baghdad. Much of it's been restored. And interestingly enough, I was reading that when the kings of Babylon put bricks into the place, Nebuchadnezzar would have his name and his symbol put on the bricks. And Saddam Hussein rebuilt much of Babylon with Saddam Hussein's name on the bricks. So present-day Babylon is the name of Saddam Hussein on many of its bricks, not Nebuchadnezzar. But that's, you see, Babylon never changes. And so the issue for you and for me is, as we face the future, as we face our lives, where is our hope, our confidence, our strength going to be? Our strength must be in humility before the Lord. And our strength must be in the confidence that he knows what he's doing and that for his people he works all things together for good. That's what this chapter really is all about. The fall of Babylon, the continuation of the heavenly city, Jerusalem. That's what the narrative of the Bible is all about. May God bless his word to us.